All right, 12 minutes past 7 o'clock, and it's at this time every Sunday morning when we get the latest from the world of news, current affairs, and we unpack some of the week's top stories from home and abroad this morning. I'm joined by journalist Graham Raubenheimer, and we'll be chatting to Katie McDonald in just a sec. Graham, good morning to you, sir.
Morning, morning, morning. I'm so sorry that you couldn't get a full night's rest last night. That sucked.
Dude.
I'm sorry, man.
Listen, it does suck, doesn't it? It's not good, actually. However, I'd like to say I'm still in fine fettle this morning, although failure to press the microphone on button might be evidence to the contrary of that. What have you got for us? Because you are definitely going to be on top form for sure.
Yeah, so my superpower is sleeping, so I don't really have any trouble in that regard. So
you don't have like children, do you, Graham?
I don't.
No.
I look to keep it that way.
Wave goodbye to that superpower, should that ever change. Right. Speaking of power, or lack of, Eskom, go.
Yeah, 100%. So, I mean, first of all, I just want to say congratulations to the Springboks last night for edging a huge win against their rivals, Wales, 32-29 at Loftus. And the irony of this is, like, this is the first time that the Springboks, the world champions, could actually play on home soil. But a lot of people couldn't watch it because there were power cuts. And they continued last night, stage four, as you rightfully said earlier, stage four, and then, you know, stage two overnight. This is our situation as we go into the week. I'd like to tell you this morning, SJ, that, you know, the probability of us not having, you know, stage six again is low, but we just don't know, as the South African public, as we go into the next week, what the situation is actually going to look like. And we know that these Eskom striking workers are back at their posts. They're supposed to be ensuring that the power plant generating units are being maintained, that the fuel reserves are not being dipped into, and so that the system can continue. But that still hasn't really been happening as per normal. And I don't know if we don't know yet if workers that had previously been striking are still on some go slow when it comes to maintenance. Sunday Times this morning, SJ is running a story, a big headline, why South Africa should brace for a future of long and costly blackouts. And it's alluding to a report, SJ, basically saying that half of the generating units at 14 of Eskom's power plants are basically are breaking down within 9 months of being repaired again. So, you know, the worst performers out of these are out of service for nearly 70% of the time. So you can imagine that with these extremely old power plants, Eskom's had to make sure that, you know, it's trying to keep the lights on as best as possible. But we are dealing with an old system. Many of the books that have been previously written on Eskom and say and signify one thing, and I had this conversation recently as well, it's a fact that Eskom was built out of a system that only benefited a small minority of people previously in this country.
Yeah.
And because of the massive population boom that we've seen since 1994 in South Africa, it's just not fit for purpose for so many people. And really, now's the time for government to act. And I just want to leave you with this last thing. I'm busy with a project at the moment to try and figure out what big metros are doing to wean off the grid. Cape Town, you know, they're trying to get 300 megawatts of its own power online. That, I must tell you, is going to take another 3 years. And the city of Joburg is actually now teaming up with Cape Town to try and see how they can bolster things their side. But they're dealing with an old grid in Joburg, and that's going to take quite a long time. And the big part of their capital budget is just going into fixing the old grid. So it's kind of like what Eskom's doing as well. A big part of its budget is just going into making sure that those old plants still work.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about these traffic bylaws in Cape Town. These are amended traffic bylaws. What does it mean? Who's it going to impact? And what's this? Where did this come from?
So this is quite interesting. I got a message this morning, SJ, about this new City of Cape Town amended traffic bylaw that's coming into operation. It's just gotten the go-ahead from the provincial government. So in other words, it's ratified. It's about to become law in Cape Town. So if you and I basically abandon our vehicle on the side of the N1 highway, or you know, our car was stolen in a hijacking, or, you know, it's a public transport vehicle that doesn't have the proper operating licenses, or they're off a certain route, then previously the law says City of Cape Town traffic officials can now can impound that vehicle. But the new amended regulations as part of the traffic bylaw, SJ, basically says that if a traffic officer sees somebody dicing or in illegal street racing and they catch that person in the act, they can now impound that vehicle on the spot.
Sure.
So that's a brand new power that has been given to the City of Cape Town's traffic officials as they look to clamp down on this. Apparently, they could also do this to people who are driving around and not correctly displaying their number plates. So not just errant minibus taxi drivers, not just illegal street racers or Dices SJ, even people who are not properly showing the number plates on their cars could even be stopped and have their vehicle impounded. So the Cape Town traffic officials are getting a lot more power. As you know, in the City of Cape Town as well, we also have the cell phone bylaw. If you're caught on your cell phone with distracted driving, maybe with the text on your phone, they can confiscate that phone on the spot. And so this is just another one of you know, those measures that the rest of the country's rest of the country's traffic law enforcement officials don't necessarily have. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that sort of plays out. We know that street racing is a big deal in Cape Town, especially on the west coast towards Atlantis. Any time of the night, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you'll hear screeching cars.
Graham, how would one improperly display their license plate?
I don't know. I think it's like if it'd have to be upside down or if it's falling off the car.
Right.
And that's sort of the interesting thing, right? It's just because a lot of times with these laws, we don't know what it looks like in practice.
Yeah,
it's up
exactly.
To the journalists to go and see exactly how these things are being done. So I can't wait to see, you know, a motoring journalist or somebody out there just to go and sort of police or go out to the cops and see how this thing is done.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're screeching around and you sort of, trying to dice your mate on the N1, I mean, yeah, you could get your car taken away, which
quite
is the
right.
Whole thing about pink slips, right? If you're racing against another guy, that's the whole thing in like the Fast and the Furious. If you race another guy on the street and you lose your car, but now you could lose your car forever.
Good, quite right. Serves you right. I tell you what, as I was driving home yesterday, in fact, right by Hospital Bend, which is not somewhere you want to be playing silly whatnots ever, and just two cars and essentially dicing with each other, and I thought, are you right in the head? Do you have any concept that it's always the people, isn't it, who think they're great drivers and that they're they're invincible.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I don't think I'm invincible and I don't trust your driving. The fact that you're doing this on a Saturday morning at, 11:30 says to me that you're a bit of a tool. So actually, I don't trust my life in your hands. Get off the road, you idiot.
Yeah.
Ooh, 7:19 and already a rant. Listen, tell us, I remember when Donald Trump was president and there used to be all these, there used to be at least an article a week about the latest ludicrous things that he'd said. You've got something in a similar vein for us, Graham.
I don't want to be like cynical or funny about this, but I actually miss Donald Trump because he used to say some absolutely ridiculous things on, and it used to just, entertain me to no end. But sadly, that reality TV show ends and a new season starts with Joe Biden. And we know that Joe Biden sends a whole bunch of, he says strange things sometimes. And I think, he's one of the oldest presidents ever. And, his tongue does betray him quite a lot. And now at the recent NATO summit, he said that Switzerland was going to be joining NATO. So we all know that Switzerland's a neutral country. And then he actually had to correct himself very quickly and said, I'm getting really anxious here, quote, about expanding NATO, he joked, before adding Sweden for the record. So he was meant to say Sweden instead of Switzerland. And apparently it sent off alarm bells in Russia for like a little bit. But and then there was also this crazy story of, oh my word, Boris Johnson. So Boris Johnson's basically, I don't know if I'm going to get you started on something yet, SJ, but he's basically the British Donald Trump, if you will. A lot of people have likened him to that. And now he claims, and I ran the story in my bulletins early in the week, that if Russia was led by a woman, that Russia wouldn't be at war right now with Ukraine. Yeah, and the interesting responses that came from Russia, oh my goodness, you'd think all diplomacy has gone out the window. The Kremlin quipped by saying that Johnson would have been a great subject for Sigmund Freud's research. And then the Russian foreign ministry claimed that Johnson has, quote, sweaty fantasies.
Hi.
What are these people doing? Just get on with governing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, please.
And
just
then lastly, it was Putin. I don't know if you saw this, but he was the butt of the joke at the G7 summit as well. So Boris Johnson and his Canadian counterpart, Justin Trudeau. They were all meant to sit down for a quick lunch. And then, you know, the press come in and they take their photos. And then the press overheard Boris Johnson basically saying, they were asking about whether or not they should take their jackets off before the picture. And then basically Johnson said they shouldn't because they need to look buff and strong for Putin. And then Trudeau came and quipped that maybe they should recreate that infamous picture of Putin riding on that horse in 2009 with his shirt off, and then they had a big fat laugh about it.
Oh,
so our politicians are really just throwing it out the window this week, and apparently they're just they're not too busy. They can laugh about all the things that are sort of facing us in the world from the negative slides. Well, there you go.
I must tell you something, Graham. When I was in my early days of being a journalist, I worked in local radio in the UK, and the two patches that I covered, one, the MP for the patch was former Prime Minister Theresa May, and the other was current British Prime Minister, but MP at the time, Boris Johnson. And they were regular, you know, I'd regularly interview them.
Yeah.
Theresa May was, as you would imagine, as terrifying as you would imagine. But Boris Johnson wasn't remotely terrifying. In fact, he was, you know, a complete buffoon. And never in our wildest dreams did we imagine that he would one day be the Prime Minister. So it's quite strange to, and I look back on some of the interviews that I sort of did over the years and think, gosh, really? That's you've done well or not. Strange. Anyway.
You inadvertently got him elected.
I know. I do sometimes sit at night, head in hands, thinking I've had some sort of finger in this. Graham, thanks very much indeed, chum. We'll chat
so
to you
much.
Again next week. From Graham in, where is Graham? Cape Town. Is he in Cape Town? Yes, he is. To Katie in Sydney. Morning, Katie.
Good morning or good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to you. Good afternoon. We've been having some wouldn't say extreme weather, but some wet weather this weekend. But you've been having extreme weather down under.
Yes, it's extreme weather yet again. I mean, look, we keep having these what they call these major flooding events, you know, once in 100 year floods, which are happening definitely more often than once in 100 years. So this is the third major one since March, and there were warnings issued last week. They obviously saw it on its way, but basically it's hit Sydney and surrounding areas, torrential rains, all over emergency services on high alert, evacuation orders out, especially from people in low-lying areas. Yeah, they're concerned about flash flooding, coastal erosion and everything that goes with it. So it's just yet another example of this unpredictability. Yeah, these extreme weather patterns that sadly some people are being more exposed to than others. Look, it's pretty horrific here in Sydney, but it's not anything like outside. I mean, you didn't want to be on the roads, for example, yesterday evening, but it's bad. So it's going to go on till next week, Sarah Jane.
Tell me about climate protesters now. So harsher laws have been introduced. But they seem undeterred by these new laws. Talk to us about that.
Well, yeah, it's kind of almost a bit of a sort of, appropriate segue. So Monday morning, traffic disrupted on the Harbour Bridge, and you'll probably be well aware that there's a tunnel that goes under the bridge as well. So a young 22-year-old activist pulled her car across a couple of lanes of traffic. She actually put her head through a bicycle lock and attached herself to a steering wheel. Yes, rather uncomfortable. As you can imagine, horrifically disruptive at peak hour traffic times. And she's part of a group called Blockade Australia. So they're involved in what they call climate activism. It's considered to be quite combative, disruptive, and some say potentially dangerous. And earlier on this year, in response to some of these more, combative protests, the New South Wales Parliament enacted pretty strict laws. In fact, they're being looked at by the Human Rights Commission. So essentially, if you protest and disrupt business activities here in New South Wales, you can be sentenced up to 2 years in prison or up to a $20,000 fine.
Hmm.
And prior to that, there was no jail time and a measly $400 fine. So that's also interesting because we had no Bill of Rights in Australia. So there's nothing that enshrines freedom of, speech, which some people are quite amazed by. And therefore, the government can enact these pretty harsh laws and get the police to enforce them. And climate groups feel that they're being unfairly targeted and that they need to protest and sod what happens to them with regards to the law.
Your next story is fascinating, and I'm trying to, and since you sent it this morning, I've been trying to work out where I stand on it. A woman has of Papuan heritage was barred entry into a club because she had these cultural tattoos on her face, and she's now saying that it was racist and that she shouldn't have been banned. What more can you tell us about this story? Because for me, I need to have more information before I sort of decide on which side of my sword I'm going to fall.
Well, look, it is an interesting one, and it is kind of divisive and complex and such. So yes, she was barred from entry to a nightclub. Now she's a Papuan Australian woman, and under her tradition or her Papuan traditions, facial tattoos are, well, they're becoming more prominent now, but it's historical. It's called Reva Reva. They have different meanings. Now, you've got to understand, too, that this is an area, in the Pacific, Sarah Jane. So you've got a lot of Pacific cultures, New Zealand as well, where tattooing is culturally significant. And it was quite interesting because a professor at one of the universities mentioned, he said, the problem is that in Western culture, tattoos, and these are his words, are symbols of lower class masculinity and criminality. But culturally, it's pretty harsh, pretty out there. But culturally here, so the Papua New Guineans, the Samoans, the Tongans and such, they're significant, and that includes the facial tattoos. So it's quite interesting. The Queensland Human Rights Commission, they're looking at it because they're going to, have a good think with regards to their anti-discriminatory laws. There's been talk that the owners of the venue could be breaching human rights laws, but basically they need to look at this because, I don't know, Sarah Jane. You say you've got to work out where you stand.
I know where I stand now. You've given me enough information for me to be able to make a decision now. And what I will say is that we have to stop always, and we do it in this country too, seeing everything through a Western or a white or a European lens when it comes to beauty, when it comes to what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. It's ridiculous that we do that in Africa. I think it's ridiculous that we do that any place in the world, but just by virtue of how transient and everything so many countries are and the rich heritage that so many countries have. Can't do that anymore. And to have, it's not about do I like tattoos or don't I like tattoos. That's not what the issue is at hand. The issue is the lens through which a judgment is being made, and that's where the problem is for me.
And respect for the culturally diverse.
I agree. If it was, and I was going to say, if it was just a thing of the tattoos of themselves were the cultural thing, but they haven't always been worn on the face, and she decided to have them on the face, and they were like, look, well, actually, our whole thing is don't have stuff on your face. That might be a different thing. But if her culture is that's what, the tattoo is on the face, it's probably not even called a tattoo in her culture. It doesn't come with the whole connotations when we, as you said, that little bit that you described, what did you say? For working class men, what? What was it?
In Western culture, symbols of lower class masculinity and criminality.
I mean, also, what an antiquated view of tattoos. Also, no.
Exactly.
I'm banging my gavel and I'm saying utter nonsense. and also utter nonsense. And I'm sorry that I have to call you on this, Katie, to be the voice of apology from your countrymen. But a certain Australian tennis player didn't come out covered in glory at Wimbledon earlier this week.
He certainly didn't. So Kyrgios, yes, he was playing Tsitsipas. I can't pronounce it properly. Apologies there. That's culturally inept or ethnically inept. But yeah, it was one of those things. Look, his opponent apparently hit some shot that in a previous match in another country had been called, yeah, it had been called the default or something. But Kyrgios, in his way, threw his toys out the cot and a tantrum and more bad language and goodness knows what else. And, you know, he's spoken about a lot here. You know, we look back at the bad boys of tennis, such as McEnroe, but...
That's the name. I couldn't find it. I couldn't get to it. John McEnroe, that's right.
John McEnroe, but he's next level. And I think for a lot of Aussies, we do like to be proud of our sports stars, but I'm not too sure where I'm sitting on this one. Yeah, and what more he's going to do at Wimbledon, because it doesn't matter where he is. He's pretty out there with his behaviour.
Yeah, I think probably don't go to Wimbledon and start spitting and screaming at the judge. Ideally, I get it, you're under enormous pressure. However, not great. Thank you for that, Katie. That you've given us some cracking stories there. I'm going to think about those cultural tattoos for the rest of the day. Thank you very much indeed. Katie is with us every Sunday morning for the Sunday Morning News Review. It's 7:33.